Listener's warning. Some topics covered in today's episode might not be appropriate for listeners under the age of 13. I will be covering controversial beliefs in the spiritual arts and touch upon crimes against humanity, namely, the Black Code upheld during the time of slavery in the United States. These topics should be openly talked about, as they are reminders of a time when races were violently divided and many people were forced into a life of another's creation, this leading to the continued division among the human race we experience worldwide today. Thank you for remaining open-minded. If you have ever been to the southern U.S. state of Louisiana, you become aware very quickly how time seems to slow down. There is no rush to get anywhere, as there's so much to absorb within the culture that surrounds you. The people are friendly, welcoming, and curious about who you are and where you came from. The heat experienced in this part of the country is mixed with 100% humidity at times, which has created the need to manufacture the iconic building style found in Louisiana in a way that is unlike anywhere in the northern regions. Each building has multiple windows, and when opened, these frames to the outside world catch a rare breeze that flows through the entire home. If you find yourself wandering the streets of Louisiana's most famous city, New Orleans, you will experience a world divided. On one side of Canal Street, New Orleans looks and feels very much like any other modern city in the US, but on the other, you are transported back into time as the sights, sounds, and smells of the French Quarter fill your senses with jazz music, cobbled streets, art, comfort food, and drink. This part of the city is also well known for magic and mystery. Many people travel to New Orleans each year in search of a woman who died long ago, but is said to still grant wishes from the beyond. A voodoo queen who was so well known in her time that news of her passing in the year 1881 made headlines in papers as far away as New York City. A woman whose life and service to her community is wrapped in myth and curiosities. The spiritual work she was said to prescribe to is one of the most misunderstood spiritual practices in the Western world, adding to her tale of mystery. In today's episode, I'll be sharing what I've learned about Madame Marie Laveau. Madame Laveau has such a presence in our collective consciousness that even those who know very little about the mystical arts know her name. This exploration has taken me back into my studies on voodoo and brought to light some of the truths about this powerful woman and her spiritual practice that can only be found if you dive below the surface of the headlines. Welcome to the dark side of light work. I'm Wynn Thornley. In life, I'm a professionally practicing esoteric teacher and channel to the ethers, specializing in demystifying the dark arts and the paranormal. I'm also a supernatural nerd and do a lot of personal research into things that go bump in the night. My fascination with the unknown began when I was a kid, due to having my own misunderstood psychic experiences. I believe my lifelong fascination with the strange and unusual has prepared me for the work I'm called to do now, taking me to places other lightworkers will not go. These experiences have taught me a lot about how many fallacies we are told and actually believe about the world of the unknown. Join me as I share with you what I've learned about the realms of the paranormal, mystics of the past, and places that might make you feel uneasy. I want to lift the veil a little bit and take the Hollywood out of the supernatural and metaphysics. And if you like what you hear, follow along by subscribing and please tell your friends. I wanted to start this episode by giving a big shout out to Michelle Smith. Thank you so much for joining my Patreon community in the month of April. Take a scroll back and see the extra perks you now have access to, including 2 virtual haunted field trips, the latest Patreon exclusive episodes, and some bonus meditations. I appreciate your support in my independent podcast efforts, and this also goes for all the loyal Patreons who have joined over the last couple of years. I'm so grateful. If you're interested in learning more about what goes on over at my Patreon community, I have a link ready for you in my show notes. One other announcement that I have for you today involves the launching of 2 new haunted field trip experiences coming fall of 2022. Both will take place in Banff National Park, Alberta. The first location I have already done a podcast episode on and might sound familiar to you. I loved the time I had spent in Lake Minnewanka and Bankhead so much that I created a 1-day field trip to this part of Banff National Park. I will be revisiting the history of Lake Minnewanka and demystifying the haunted tales associated with this lake. We will also explore the Bankhead ruins and learn more of that ghost town's history. The second field trip will take us into the town of Banff and to one of Alberta's paranormal hotspots. To begin this one-day field trip, we will explore the Old Banff Cemetery and I will host a workshop on the dead and cemeteries. Next, we will head to the world-famous Fairmont Banff Springs Hotel, where we will wander and talk about the haunted history of this iconic hotel. During both of these field trips, I will carve out time to teach you how to use your psychic senses in real-world conditions. We will tune into these paranormal hotspots together and ghost hunt from a medium's perspective. It's going to be a spooky good time. Want to join the fun? Make sure to head to my show notes to find a link to my website where you can learn more and register for these events. Space is limited and registration is open until August 19th, 2022 or until all the tickets are sold. While you're on the events section of my website, be sure to check out the information I have up about the upcoming July 2022 haunted field trip. This is a weekend event taking us to Frank Slide, Alberta. We will explore an important Canadian historical site with a dark history. There are three mini workshops included in this weekend, and registration is open until June 17, 2022. I invite you to join us. A group is already forming, and there are 9 tickets left. Okay, enough about haunted field trips. Now, on to the show. Marie Laveau has been a longtime interest of mine. She came into my consciousness the first time I traveled to New Orleans with a good friend of mine. On our list of places to visit was Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo, where we shopped and received a reading by a Southern woman who has been working with spirit for over 70 years. It was a small shop filled with all kinds of trinkets, posters, and other touristy items to prove that you were there. In this one trip alone, my travel mate and I visited 4 or 5 different voodoo-inspired shops, and I found Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo to be the most mainstream of them all. In both trips I've been lucky to take to New Orleans, I had a chance to visit the tombs of Marie Laveau in the St. Louis I Cemetery. I say tombs because I heard rumors that the famous large white tomb with the X's inscribed and offerings left might not be the actual crypt of the famous voodoo queen. There is another tomb in St. Louis I that is also marked up with many gifts and trinkets left as an offering in exchange for granting wishes of those desperate for help from Laveau's spirit. Both times I visited the famous tomb of Marie Laveau, it was indeed covered with X's and offerings of cigarettes, alcohol, and hair ties left in front of the tomb. I even witnessed two ladies going through the proper ritual one needs to go through so their offerings would be accepted and their wishes granted by the voodoo queen in the beyond. How does it go again? Yes. First, you must begin by knocking 3 times on the tomb, and then, only then, may you ask her for a favor. Wait, that's not it. I think you're supposed to draw 3 X's, place your hand over them, rub your foot 3 times against the bottom of the tomb, throw some silver coins in the cup attached to the front, and make your wish. That can't be right. To receive a wish, you need to leave offerings of food, money, and flowers, and only then can you ask for Marie's help after turning around 3 times and marking 3 crosses with red brick on the stone. Hold on. But I also read you have to walk backwards towards her tomb and then backwards out of the cemetery somewhere. There certainly seems to be a lot of rituals one can do to invoke the spirit of Marie Laveau to grant wishes. Each of these are said to come from the tradition of voodoo. However, after researching this episode, I'm not sure that is even accurate to voodoo traditions. The more you dive into things like voodoo, hoodoo, and Marie Laveau, the more things become clear. There seems to be a lot of myths around this renowned voodoo queen of New Orleans. She's talked about in many podcasts, on websites, books, and her tale is twisted in Hollywood as well. To be honest, the whole reason I decided to explore Marie Laveau at this time was because I just finished watching one of my favorite seasons of the TV show American Horror Story. It's the 3rd season called Coven. They sure do a great job weaving a tale about Marie Laveau, Madame Laurier, and what it's like working voodoo as black magic. This was a big research project as there was a lot to sort through. So let's get into it, shall we? I will begin this podcast episode with the accepted history of Madame Marie Laveau, the one spread far and wide without any questioning. And then I will demystify that tale and share what I've learned about the real Marie Laveau and voodoo in general. Marie Catherine Laveau's accepted date of birth is September 10th of 1801, though it is disputed. Her birth records were lost, and there are some sources from my research stating that she was born 7 years earlier in the year 1794. What is known for certain is that Marie was born a free woman of color and is believed she was birthed in colonial New Orleans. She was the biological daughter of Marguerite d'Arcantel and Charles Laveau Trudeau, though she was raised by her grandmother, and I want to address this for a moment. Laveau's grandmother's name was Miss Catherine Henry. It took a lot of time to patch together her origins with many conflicting sources. At first, it appeared as though her and her mother were taken from their home in West Africa in the mid-1700s to be sold into slavery when they arrived into New Orleans. Many sources agreeing Catherine would have been around 7 years old at this time. But then I stumbled upon a site where some genealogists collaborate, and the story became more clear. What I found there was that Catherine was more than likely born into slavery herself. Her mother's origins were traced back to the Senegal area of West Africa, where she was stolen as a child to be sold into the Louisiana slave market, this taking place in 1742. At that time, her name was changed to Marguerite. Once she arrived in Louisiana, Marguerite was sold to a white Creole man named Henry Rocher, also known as Henry Rocher Belair, who in life was a master shoemaker. I just want to touch on something for a minute here. For those who don't know much about the Creole culture, let me give you a little backstory. To be known as Creole means you are part of an ethnic group that originated during the colonial era as a result of racial mixing, mainly involving West Africans as well as some people born in the colonies, such as French, Spanish, and Indigenous American peoples. Creole peoples vary widely in ethnic background and mixture, and many have since developed distinct ethnic identities. Back to Marguerite. Marguerite would conceive her first child, Catherine, in 1754 by a man named John Belair, who is thought to have also been a slave of Henry Rocher's. There's not much else I could find about Marguerite and Jean, so I'm only to assume they spent the remainder of their years owned by Rocher. Catherine would have four children herself, and all of them of mixed race. It is thought that Henry Rocher was the father of at least one of her children, one she called Marguerite, in honor of her own mother. Whether Catherine's other children were fathered by Rocher or another white man, it is unknown. But Catherine's time with Rocher would end, and she would eventually be passed around to three more owners before she could buy her way to freedom in the year 1794. Catherine would go on to own her own home and become a savvy businesswoman in her own right, working hard with the goal to buy all of her children's freedom, which I read that she did. She would pass away by the year 1831. All this took place even though Louisiana had a specific set of rules in regards to master and slave relations. In the early 1700s, there was a black code, known as the Code Noir. This was written up by King Louis of France in 1724, later to be revised in 1769. The Code Noir was an official royal order that outlined the expected disciplinary actions and rules owners of black slaves within Louisiana had to abide by. The time frame I'm dealing with regarding Marguerite, Catherine, and her children's story was before the Louisiana Purchase, which wouldn't happen until 1803, a couple of years after Marie Laveau was born. Louisiana was still a colony under France's rule. This edict was supposed to regulate how the enslaved were to be treated and guidelines for the white masters to follow, though I can't imagine these guidelines were respected by many of the owners. Case in point, the fathers of Catherine's children. Some of the recommendations detailed punishments that were of the high standard of the Roman Catholic Church, if you will. One of the most extreme involved violence against the master. If a slave were to strike their master and break skin or cause bruising, this act was punishable by death. The Code Noir was created in order to keep the oppressed in line, but was also very strict on how the owners were to engage with the enslaved. The Code Noir had policies on marriages and sexual relationships as well, not only for the black slaves who coupled, but also for the white masters, their family members, and any children that resulted from interracial relationships. Codes numbered 6 through 10 of the Code Noir cover this in detail. I already shared some photos I took of the 1724 version of the Code Noir while visiting the Laura Plantation back in 2012 to my Patreon community. This is so you can read through its entirety yourself. But here's a quick overview in regards to relationships and the children resulting. Any child born of two slaves automatically became a slave of the mother's master, not the father's. Though bondservants from different households were not really supposed to congregate in any way according to the Code Noir. When it came to interracial relations, These were strictly forbidden, whether they were just sexual in nature or wanting to unite in marriage. In discovery of such a union with a child being conceived, the master of the enslaved would pay a hefty fine. If this child was fathered by the master himself or one of his family members, this would result in the mother and child being removed from the property to be enslaved indefinitely with new owners. This also goes for the child conceived by a white woman with an enslaved man. This child would immediately be sold into a life of slavery and the master of the home heavily fined. Though I'm not sure the punishment for the white woman, but it was more than likely social outcasting. But there would be, without a doubt, severe punishment handed down to the bondsmen involved. So when it comes to Catherine and the father of at least one of her children, Marguerite, I can only assume that this situation was kept as a family secret. It was documented that Rocher sold Catherine plus her infant child at the time to a man named Bartholome Magnon in the year 1784, with Marguerite remaining with her father and master. There was a couple of ways for the enslaved to become free before the Emancipation Proclamation of 1803. When the Code Noir was replaced with the Código Negro in 1769, the bond servants were given the right to buy their way out of enslavement. Enslaved women had more choice and could marry a free black man within a Catholic church and would be freed in due time. For those who chose to buy their way out, it could take a lifetime, but it could be done. This was the goal of Miss Catherine. Beginning with the Code Noir, all those enslaved had Sundays off. Sundays became a day where the enslaved would gather in Congo Square after church services. They would gather to practice their ancestral beliefs of voodoo, dance, and sell their wares, including services and items related to the practice of voodoo. This was how many of the enslaved were able to buy their way to freedom. By the time Catherine's daughter Marguerite was 18, she was freed from her father's estate, only to be forced in an arranged marriage of sorts with an older, rich white man named Henry d'Arcantel. Technically, she was more of a concubine to this man, considering they weren't legally able to marry. One more insult to lifelong injury for Marguerite. Even though she was now free, she was again to live a life of oppression. Marguerite would go on to have three children in this living arrangement, none of which would be baby Marie. Marie was Marguerite's last child and came about within an affair. This affair would be with a man whom Marguerite would claim to be her one true love. This was a man named Charles Laveau, who was the son of a very important politician. I believe he was a white Creole man who would go on to become the mayor of New Orleans. This unexpected pregnancy was hidden from Henry in fear of severe consequences. Marguerite birthed Marie in the home of her mother, Miss Catherine Henry, making the difficult decision to leave her love child behind to be raised by her mother. She then returned to her role as Henry's concubine, and this is where the research portion pretty much ended for Marie Laveau's mother. A little more on her father was discovered in my research, and I'll cover that a little bit later. Marie Catherine Laveau would be the first woman of color born free in her family since her great-grandmother was stolen from Senegal in the mid-1700s. Miss Catherine would raise her in the adobe cottage she built at the old site once known as 152 Rue Saint Anne. This would be the same cottage Marie would purchase much later in her life. It is well known that Marie Laveau was a free woman of color, but with all that I've learned about her family lineage, it is quite clear that she was a blend of many backgrounds. Many sources I read were quite comfortable labeling Madame Laveau as Creole. She was known to be very tall in stature and quite stunning in appearance. As an adult, Laveau would wear a headdress wrapped with 7 points. This was a symbol of her freedom. Many free women of color would don a headdress for this reason. There was very little information I could find about Laveau from her childhood with the resources I had at the time of this research project, except that she was lovingly raised by her grandmother, Miss Catherine. Miss Catherine was a wealth of wisdom when it came to her people relations, her business sense, and her relationship with her faith. This would most definitely rub off onto Laveau as she grew into adulthood. Her grandmother would often take Laveau to Congo Square on Sundays, making sure she was connected to her West African heritage. This being after their attendance to their Catholic church service, of course. Miss Catherine was proud of her Catholic faith, and I read somewhere that she bragged about never missing a Sunday service. Marie Laveau might be most well known for practicing voodoo, but she was also a devout Catholic. She proudly served her Catholic community her entire life, and I will get into that a little bit later in this episode. For now, I will explore more of her life after the age of 18, beginning with her first husband. Jacques Perry was a Creole man of color who arrived in New Orleans from his native country of Haiti in around the year 1809. Like many others from his Haitian community, he left home due to the Haitian Revolution. This was an incredibly violent period of time where the enslaved of Haiti would overflow the French regime. Arriving in New Orleans as a free man, Perry would use his skills as a carpenter, making a living as a cabinet maker. Perry and Lebeau would marry in the year 1819 in the Grand Saint Louis Cathedral. We know that Charles Lebeau was in attendance because we can find his signature on their marriage certificate documenting himself as Marie's birth father. As a gift to his daughter and new husband, Marie's father gifted the couple their first home, one he owned on Love Street, today known as North Rampart. It seems as though Marie and Jacques lived on Love Street for a short time. As I read, by 1822, they were documented as living in a residence on Dufane Street between Dumain and St. Philip. As far as a family, some sources say Marie and Jacques had no children together. However, many others agree that they had two children. One source stating this was recorded in the St. Louis Cathedral baptismal records. Marie Angélie Perry, baptized in 1823, and Félicité Perry, baptized in 1824. Both children are listed as daughters of Marie Lebeau and Jacques Perry. Félicité's baptismal records state that she was actually 7 years old at the time of her baptism. This kind of indicates that Félicité was about 2 years old by the time her mother and father married. This is where the records get a little vague. Apparently, it was documented on the girl's baptismal records that Jacques was deceased by this time. It is believed Perry passed away sometime in 1822, and there are conflicting stories in his disappearance from the public record. Some believe Perry abandoned his family and went back to Haiti. Others want his disappearance to be a little more sinister in nature. It was suspected by some that his wife had a hand in his disappearance. Did Marie Lebeau use a killing hearts conjurer, also known as a death conjurer, on her first husband? Not likely. For one, Marie would call herself the Widow Perry for the remainder of her life, even after she entered into her next long-term love affair. And for two, there were waves of cholera and typhoid that hit New Orleans in the 1820s, with an epidemic of yellow fever that came after that, devastating the city by the 1850s. It was quite possible that Jacques Perry passed away due to illness, and with waves of contagious disease taking out between 10 and 50% of the New Orleans population depending on the wave, it might not have been recorded. Unfortunately, all documentation of Marie's first two daughters also stopped shortly after their baptism. It is believed they did not survive into adulthood due to the cholera and typhoid outbreaks. By the year 1826, Marie would welcome a new man into her life. This would be a man named Christophe Dominique Dumigny de Glapignon, a white man with a French nobility background. She would have a long relationship with Glapignon, though they would never marry. They would eventually reside in Marie's childhood home of 152 Rue Saint-Anne, and sources were conflicting on how Marie gained ownership. Christophe might have been involved in the acquiring of Laveau's grandmother's adobe cottage, though other sources say it was a client who was so grateful to Marie for a successful conjure that they purchased the cottage as a gift for her. Either way, when Miss Catherine died, there was a debt connected to this home, and it was to be auctioned off. Marie desperately wanted to take over the cottage and make it her own, so much so that she received help in taking over the title. More than likely, it was Christophe that helped make this happen. This was the home that Marie would live in until her passing in 1881. Lebeau and Glapignon would live together until his death in 1855. They would have many children together and were documented as having 7 slaves in between their two households. When it comes to the children that came from this union, some sources say there were as many as 15, but the baptismal records show that Marie and Christophe had 7 children together. Only 2 of their children would survive into adulthood. 2 daughters, Marie Eucharist Eloise Lebeau, who was born in 1827 and recorded to have passed away in 1862, and the younger daughter, Marie Philomène Glapignon. Marie Philomène was born in 1836 and lived a long life, passing away in 1897, where it is recorded she died of drowning. Marie Philomène would also be known as Marie Lebeau II, and would be deeply involved in the practice of voodoo, maybe even more than her mother. But before I get ahead of myself, let's explore voodoo for a moment here and reveal the real interest behind Marie Laveau's fame. Voodoo is one of the most misunderstood spiritual practices in the Western world. Thought to originate in West Africa, voodoo has ancient roots and has seen its greatest evolution beginning in the 1700s with its arrival to the Americas. The voodoo practice in Haiti is much closer to its African origins than the Louisiana branch. I'll be focusing on the practices found in New Orleans specifically because this is what I know best myself. I've been fascinated by voodoo since I was a child. I read a little bit about it from some Reader's Digest books my parents had on their bookshelf, namely one volume called Into the Unknown. That was my paranormal Bible as a kid. Some of the images I found in that book would frighten others, but they called to me in a different way. Voodoo, or the paranormal in general, never seemed evil to me, just very visceral. As an adult, and after spending time in New Orleans where voodoo could be easily accessible for this Canadian gal, I decided to learn more about this spiritual practice. While I am by no means an expert, I have learned enough to share some of the very basics with you in this episode. I encourage you to explore the subject more yourself after this podcast episode is over. Voodoo, or voodan, is an African word that translates to English as spirit or deity. The belief is that voodoo lives all around us, in the rocks, streams, trees, plants, animals, and other elementals of our world of color, as well as in a hierarchy of deities and our ancestors in the beyond. Voodoo in the Western world is known as being a spiritual practice where worship of multiple deities and the ancestors is the focus, as well as the practice of what is known as hoodoo, root work, or conjuring, among other names. Voodoo is practiced in many parts of West Africa, the Caribbean, chiefly Haiti, and the southern United States, though I'm sure you can find practitioners all over the world these days. New Orleans voodoo is a blend of West African, Roman Catholic, Native American, and European spiritual practices. Those peoples taken from West Africa for the slave trade were forced into Catholicism when they arrived in Louisiana. In the Code Noir, it is written as a responsibility of the slave owners. They were to integrate their slaves into Catholic beliefs, and it was forbidden to own any slaves who were of another religion or spiritism. Over time, those taken from West Africa began to relate to many of the Catholic saints and angels with the Loa that they worshipped within West African voodoo. New Orleans voodoo includes both traditional Loa and Catholic saints in their practice and imagery. This was something that Marie Laveau practiced and promoted in her time. She was considered a pioneer in a way. Voodoo practitioners are taught from the elders in the community. This is how the wisdom is passed down most authentically. There are rituals that are followed closely, but are also fluid. Here are some examples of daily traditions and practices that are ritualized, but can be customized to suit the practitioner. There are certain ways that the priests and priestesses dress and adorn themselves to be recognized in public. But if you do not follow voodoo teachings, you cannot recognize the symbolic nature of their dress code. Every color in their dress, rituals, conjure, and spells are chosen practically, from the beadwork to the cloth to even the thread used. This is to attract certain deities that are desired for the greatest benefits for the hoodoo, which is really another word for voodoo, or the act of conjuring, I suppose. Gri-gri bags are very popular items bought and carried by clients and practitioners alike. They are often made of red flannel, but can be crafted in other colors. But red is most important because this color is said to be favored by the spirits. Other colors, like black or green, are chosen for more specific intentions of the bag. On a side note here, gris-gris is French for gray-gray, meaning these bags filled with roots, herbs, minerals, and other elements can be black or white magic in nature, simply saying they can work for good or evil intentions. And I think this is what has so many people confused. Many believe that voodoo is purely black magic or evil in nature, but this couldn't be further from the truth. Those who practice voodoo believe there is good and evil in this world. That is one of the driving forces behind the conjure work. But many practitioners work for the good forces and hold good intentions for their clients in order to dispel evil spirits and bad juju trying to influence their lives. Of course, there are practitioners that can be found that do practice the darker side of voodoo, but this comes with any spiritual practice, and they are few and far between. When you think about conjuring, root work, or spell work, I want you to think about this as you would any other spiritual beliefs, systems, rituals. Intention is the most important aspect of these rituals, and often elements of the earth are used to enhance the work. In voodoo, many types of trees, plants and their roots, dirt, brick, flowers, herbs, metals, and water are used. This is no different than the Catholics using water for baptism, the indigenous using smudge bundles for cleansing, or Reiki practitioners using crystals in their energy work. The intention built around using these items is partly symbolic and partly the belief in the spirit or voodoo within the earth elements being used in the ritual and how these elements add power to the intended result. But the core teaching is belief in oneself and their connection to the highest source of energy, just as it is in any other spiritual practice. With the light side, there is dark. I read in the book called Voodoo and Hoodoo by Jim Haskins, many practitioners are against work to do ill. Haskins gives many tricks and conjures of both light and dark that he was offered by the active practitioners he interviewed for his book, which was originally published in 1978, when this was more of an underground practice. It's much more popular these days. One thing Haskins mentioned about these tricks and conjurings he was offered was that there's quite possibly some elements or steps left out of them. This is because a practitioner's recipe and ritual is very sacred and should only be shared with initiates of the priest or priestess. Sure, one can try them out, but many of the items required could be difficult to obtain or there could be a step missing. Just a friendly tip for you here. One should always hold caution when trying to practice the mystical arts without the guidance of an elder or master, and this is in my humble opinion. In my personal experience within the spiritual industry, there are bad apples giving voodoo a bad rap. These are the voodoo practitioners that lack integrity and professionalism. They stand out because they are the ones sending prying emails, making random phone calls, or offering supposed free services to people. Only in the end, they eventually end up trying to convince innocent people that they are terribly cursed, and these practitioners are the only ones who can uncross this powerful magic. And the cure is only possible in exchange for a large sum of money, mind you. Please keep in mind, any legit voodoo practitioner or any other flavor of lightwork period allows their clients to find them organically and will always work from the highest benefit of all involved. Legit healers will never tell you that they are the end-all to be-all of practitioners and might even refer you out to another if they feel there's a better fit for your needs. If you do not feel connected to your healer or get the heebie-jeebies, give yourself permission to walk away, even if you feel fear or dread in the middle of a reading. This is a sign that this person is not the practitioner for you and might not be working from a place of authenticity or purity. It really grates my cheese when scammers give the spiritual industry a bad name by doing stuff like that. I cannot say this enough. Be mindful of free card pulls and free readings on social media or that arrive unsolicited in any way, shape, or form. Many times, participating in these freebies only leads to trouble. If you want some type of spell work or reading for yourself, please do your research to align to a legit practitioner and pay them for their services. The ones that just pop into your messages or inbox out of nowhere saying that they are drawn to you are not legit. I can promise you that. And I digress. Voodoo in itself is nothing to be feared and is quite an interesting practice to learn about. I left a link to a video on my show notes that is hosted by a well-known New Orleans voodoo priest named Robai. I invite you to take some time to watch and learn more about this subject from someone who is an expert in this field. One thing I wanted to address quickly here before getting back into the life of Marie Laveau is the marking of her tomb that I mentioned early in this episode. I don't know where this myth came about, the one that if you mark up her tomb with X's, leave an offering, and Marie Laveau will grant you wishes from the beyond. And I looked, let me tell you. One thing I did find out is that it is a highly disrespectful act to desecrate someone's tomb, voodoo queen or not, and absolutely does not come from any form of voodoo practices. Because of the damage done to the tomb of Marie Laveau in the St. Louis I Cemetery over the years, the public can no longer visit this cemetery freely. This was put into practice by order of the Archdiocese of New Orleans in the year 2015. Public visitation requires being part of an official tour group now, which will put you back about $20. This policy was put into action after the last act of vandalism to occur on the Glapignan family tomb where the body of Marie Laveau was said to lay. A mentally unstable man entered the St. Louis I Cemetery and painted over the entire tomb with pink paint. The cost to restore the tomb was quite expensive, and this caused the cemetery officials to lock the gates to the public. So please, respect the dead and the family of the dead. Tombstones, grave markers, and crypts are to be viewed and not touched in any circumstance. In this portion of the podcast, I would like to take a look at the myths and truths of Marie Laveau. Let's explore the accepted story of this famous Creole woman first. Many sources, videos, and articles I read say that Marie Laveau had her own business, working publicly as a hairdresser. The white women of high society were said to be her clients, and they would share their deepest secrets and fears with Marie. Not only would she style these women's hair, but she would also be hired for her knowledge of conjure, herbs, and healing. It was also quite possible that hairdressing was a cover for Marie's conjure work, giving her clients a cover story to hire the voodoo queen. When it came to her voodoo practice, Marie did not do this out of her salon. She was known to do this side of her work out of her home, in her client's home, at the Congo Square Market on Sundays, or on the waters of Bayou St. John during one of the most important yearly celebrations, one known as St. John Eve. Many sources I read shared that Marie would leave the celebration of St. John Eve each year until she was well into her old age. On Sundays, Marie would offer gree-gree bags, spells, and advice to the community as a popular vendor at the Congo Market where the enslaved would gather to celebrate their West African heritage. When Marie was in her clients' homes, she would visit the bond servants after her work was done with the master. Here, she would offer special gifts of spells and gree-gree bags to the enslaved, gaining inside information about their masters in return. This information would be invaluable to Marie, as she would use this inside knowledge to embellish her magical gifts and psychic abilities around her clients. Marie Laveau was not the first known voodoo queen of New Orleans, but considered the third. What some believe is that Marie Laveau was trained under Saniti Didi and Marie Salope, Didi being the first voodoo queen of New Orleans and Salope being her successor. I really hope I pronounced those names right. Please forgive me if I didn't. There are rumors that Laveau may have even trained under one of the most famous practitioners of the time, a man named Dr. John. But it was most likely that Marie was guided by her grandmother on the blended faiths of Catholicism and voodoo practices embraced in Congo Square. Marie was also very active in her Catholic community, attending Mass regularly, with her home filled with images of the saints. She created a home that felt safe and protected for her family and visitors alike. Laveau would also support the prisoners locked up in the Cabildo, offering guidance to redemption and forgiveness through Jesus Christ. Marie Laveau was a woman known to be filled with compassion, with a strong religious faith and a clear intention to help people in her community. One last myth to explore is that Marie Laveau was ageless, with gossip around the city that she remained young up until the day she died. Let's expand on that gossip, shall we? Marie Philomene, Laveau's youngest surviving daughter, was said to be a striking image of her mother. Rumor says she would wear her mother's clothes around town, giving the impression that the great Marie Laveau was ageless. She was even referred to as Marie Laveau II in many articles and sources I came across. This may have been something that Marie Sr. and Jr. planned and played out together, adding to the mystical powers of the voodoo queen. One thing to note, the biggest difference between the two mythical accounts of mother and daughter is that Marie Philomene was said to play more in the darker side of voodoo compared to her mother, and that she eventually took over her role as voodoo queen of New Orleans when her mother was too old and frail to leave her home. But is this all true? During my research, I came across a great video on YouTube with two hosts. One is Roby, who I mentioned before, and the other is a lady named Sandy. Roby being a priest in the tradition of voodoo, and Sandy being a historical tour guide for New Orleans. They gave such great information about voodoo, historical New Orleans, and Marie Laveau that I made sure to include the link to that channel and video in my show notes for you. Sandy shares lots of information about historical documentation of Marie Laveau's life. According to Sandy's historical research, there is nothing to be found in the city records that officially shows that Marie Laveau had a hair salon or even practiced voodoo. Even in Laveau's lifetime, it was disputed that she was, in fact, the voodoo queen. What is documented is her extensive service and ministry that she gave within her Catholic community and prison. Marie never denied her Catholic faith, but at times was said to deny any affiliation with voodoo practices. She was even laid to rest in a Catholic cemetery. And as Sandy mentions in the video that I linked for you, it would be pretty unusual for someone not of devoted Catholic faith to be laid to rest in St. Louis I Cemetery, especially in 1881. They used to have a segregated area for those of Protestant faith and those of color. Eventually, all those of Protestant faith were moved to a new location known as the Girard Street Cemetery, with a small section left behind at the St. Louis I by the end of the 1800s. But with every myth, there seems to be a grain of truth. And Laveau's fame as a voodoo queen runs so deeply within the collective consciousness, maybe her denials were a cover. Or maybe the story of the famed voodoo queen belongs to somebody else. After researching this woman as deeply as I could, there was some speculation I came across indicating Marie Philomène could be the real famed Marie Laveau. There was more than one source that wondered if the hair salon might have actually been owned and operated by Marie Philomène, and that it was Philomène that openly practiced voodoo for high-end clientele. But on the other hand, there was also very little I could find about Marie Philomène to verify these speculations. To be honest, there was very little to find about her at all, except for a photo. Which is really not surprising when looking into women who lived in the 1800s and whose records could have been destroyed in fires, floods, and just poor record keeping. It was a really long research process that I would like to spend some more time on again. I wonder what fresh eyes and new leads will offer. I definitely have a couple new books on the order, and I'm looking for ways to dive deeper into the New Orleans city records from afar. So what do we know about Marie's adobe cottage? The original home on Rue St. Anne was torn down long ago, but there is a home with the address of 1020 St. Anne Street that is believed to have been built on the same site as the original cottage. Devotees of Laveau will leave offerings like hair ties, coins, and trinkets on the home in honor of the voodoo queen. I also came across some articles and videos that claim this home is haunted. Those who stay in the home claim to hear the beating of drums and chanting of souls from the beyond in the dark hours of the night. One article I read was a reported haunted experience from a couple that apparently rented this home off of the Airbnb site. So right to the Google I went. I was able to find a link titled St. Anne Creole Victorian 5 Bedroom 5 Bath that could have been the original Airbnb listing, but the link was broken and I came up empty-handed when I scoured the Airbnb site. But in my searching, I did find an MLM listing for the home. It was sold as recent as June of 2019 for about $585,000. Not to say that the owners didn't list the home elsewhere as a vacation home rental, but part of me wonders if the new owners decided to live in the home and no longer rent it out. So I'm not really sure what to tell you there. So, at the end of this, what do I believe? I believe that Marie Laveau was a devout Catholic with training in voodoo practices that leaned more towards herbology and spiritual counseling. This wisdom being passed along by the community of Congo Market and her grandmother. I believe she was a Save businesswoman in her youth, who had great connection and compassion for her community. I believe she was highly respected by all levels of society, with the wisdom and charisma to allow people to see what she desired, possibly making her known as the renowned Voodoo Queen of New Orleans. To close this episode down, I just want to say that I cannot help but respect Marie Laveau. Whether her story is true or not, her legacy as a voodoo queen has inspired many to seek the magic and ritual within themselves. In a time when we need more connection to our spiritual selves, I like to believe that the myth of Marie Laveau is part of humanity's great awakening, and that is something to be moved and inspired by. Thank you so much for popping by and spending time with me today. I really appreciate you being here. I'm excited to see an increase in loyal listeners, and I would love to hear your feedback. I invite you to leave a message at my Anchor FM page letting me know how you like it. You can also share your personal experience with a show topic or even share a show idea. I listen to each message and I may include your idea in a future episode. Since I'm an independent podcast host and producer, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, a follow on Spotify, or review on where you are listening to me right now would really help others find my show. A quick share is also really appreciated. Outside of my podcast platforms, you can find me on social media by searching for The Dark Side of Lightwork with Wynn Thornley. If you like bonus content, I invite you to check out my exclusive Patreon community. Your contribution helps with the growth and expansion of The Dark Side of Lightwork. I have lots of exclusive content available for my loyal Patreons that isn't available anywhere else. Behind-the-scenes research content, meditations, bonus episodes, and videos. Any support is welcome, and I feel grateful for all the support I have already received. Thank you so much. I'm also expanding the conversation on the dark arts, paranormal, and episode topics over on the Wisdom app. There you can find me going live about once a week. Wisdom is a blend of live radio and podcasting, as all live conversations become archived so you can listen in later. Wisdom also offers the option to chat live with me, so I invite you, be my guest and join the conversation. In my next episode, I'm going to share what I've learned about Mel's Hole, a topic request sent in from a loyal listener. Mel's Hole was first revealed by a caller named Mel Waters on the popular late-night radio show Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell in 1997. It is supposed to be located somewhere around Ellisonburg, Washington, and is apparently over 80,000 feet deep with a host of unusual properties. Thank you once again for listening into the end. I look forward to dropping the next episode soon. So until then, take good care.